Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nicolau. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this February the 16th on the West Coast, now February the 17th on the East Coast, and in the Central Time Zone. We've got a great show planned for you this evening, and before we bring our guest on, I want to welcome all those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world, whether it's live or on a post-dated archive. We appreciate you helping us spread the truth around the planet. We have a great guest for tonight's show, as I mentioned. He is a prolific author on many of the topics that we discuss on this show. His research and his writing has influenced me and fellow journalists and talk show hosts alike because of the originality and the thoroughness of the work he has done. Before we bring him on, I'm going to give you an opportunity to sort of allow yourself to relax, clear your mind, and open your heart. You're going to hear a lot of truth tonight, and we will be joining our guest after we listen to Pat Metheny and Beat 70. 70 and the Pat Metheny group. You may wonder why I chose that music. Well, Pat Metheny, as far as I know, as far as I discern, is one of the most spiritual people on the planet. Very creative individual. And I often talk about creativity and taking responsibility for one's life. Of course, we are in a paradigm which has opposing realities, and we are constantly struggling to escape those realities. Pat's music enables us to do that to some extent. And I want to also mention that my own foray into some of the material we're going to cover tonight was a result of my having gone to Europe for a three-month musical tour. I ended up staying there for 5 years. And I functioned in European society, I think, very well. I made lots of friends. I learned the languages. And I noticed a difference between the people and the government wherever I traveled around the world. And there are reasons for that. When we talk about countries by name, we're not singling out the people themselves, but the hierarchy that controls society. And of course, we've mentioned the topic of a new world order, the takeover of those that like to call themselves the elite or the Illuminati to basically enslave the whole of the planet for their own ends. It's, again, the dichotomy of the creation. And tonight we have on the show probably the world's expert on these topics. His material, his research, and his wisdom has been hijacked by a number of other writers. We won't name them. That's not important. What is important, though, is we have the source of this information with us tonight. He has written back in 1991, if I'm correct, Conspirators' Hierarchy, the story of the Committee of 300. And we're going to be discussing that with the author of that book. I'm very honored and privileged to have him with us tonight, Dr. John Coleman. Dr. Coleman, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to be on your show. I'm very honored.
Well, I suppose I could say, for the purpose of radio and the listening audience, would you care to give us the background that led you into writing this book, which is a tremendous treatise on secret societies and what makes the world go round?
The best way I can begin is to say that, like you, I spent a long time in Europe, particularly in studying at the British Museum in London. Now, this is probably the greatest repository of knowledge in the world, especially the Inner Sanctum, which is not open to the public at large. It's, of course, it's actually, you have to have a certain background, a military background. And mm-hmm. My father was an Irish guard, so they knew about me, these people, and I was researching all of their material in the British Museum in the Inner Sanctum. And I was amazed to come across documents that were really very, very frank, to the extent that they astonished me, because normally these people, that's the elite, the New World Order, the rulers of Europe, they don't put their goods in the shop window. They don't advertise. Their doings and their goings-on are very secret. When they have meetings, they're not advertised. They're very secretive about everything that takes place. And the people who are admitted, of course, only by special invitation. And there I discovered that there was a group of people who also called themselves the Olympians. The intelligence people in the world, especially in Europe, refer to them in awe as the Olympians. They themselves called themselves the Committee of 300 because there were largely 300 members, each known to each other, but not known to the rest of the world at large. And that these people virtually and fully gave the orders for world events. For instance, we think of the United States as being very independent and a free country. It is to a certain extent. But what I discovered was that the orders for the conduct of the United States came down from the Royal Institute for International Affairs, a very august body of scholars in Chatham House in London, and they were the ones who formulated certain policies for the Committee of 300, and they handed them down, and these were transmitted to various governments. In the United States, they came via Wall Street, via Morgan Guarantee and Trust, which were the agents for the Committee of 300 in the United States. And from there, their orders were given to the Secretary of State of the United States, and normally they were carried out. In instances where they weren't carried out, the authorities in charge didn't meet a very good end. And I think of people like John F. Kennedy, for instance, and others. Yeah. We've had many presidents assassinated in the United States, a very enviable record, if I may say so. And these were people who gave orders through Chatham House in London to the Secretary of State for transmission to the President, who was then expected to carry them out. And most of the time they were very subservient and very obedient to these instructions, but there were presidents who kicked over the traces, one of them being John F. Kennedy. And he started out by wanting to print United States currency. He discovered that we don't have any money in the United States. We have what are called Federal Reserve notes, which are mere, not even promissory notes, because they don't promise to pay anything. They're merely bank notes without any backing.
Yes.
And so Kennedy said, well, this is no good. I'm going to issue United States currency. And he was warned several times not to do that. But he gave orders to the Treasury, and they had, in fact, printed something in the way order of about $3 billion in U.S. currency. And they were about to distribute these to the Federal Reserve Banks when Kennedy was brutally assassinated. And we know that this never came to pass. And the currency of the United States, the Federal Reserve notes, are still the means of exchange in this country. And we've coerced other nations to accept them. And they have, to a large extent. In some instances, they refuse to do so, like Russia, for instance. And now we have China, where they kicked over the traces, so to speak, and decided they were going to have their own currency to a very large extent. And that did, to a point, break out the monopoly of the Federal Reserve banks, but not entirely. And we find that today, for instance, the bills that come due for oil that we import from Saudi Arabia, these are all paid in dollars. And there are many other of our products, key products that we need for our economy, that are also all paid in Federal Reserve notes. So by this means, they exercise financial control as well as, you might say, physical control over the population of the United States, coming down through our leaders in the White House and in the Senate and in the House of Representatives. Some people have said to me, don't they know about this group? My answer is that largely they do, but they also know very well that the people who try to buck them will find themselves at the very least without a job, or might even have a worse fate than that. So without advertising, without a great deal of fanfare, these orders are faithfully carried out. And I see it every day, actually, in politics. I look at them and see what the situations are in the world and how they're being dealt with. And the hand of the Committee of 300, to me, is unmistakable. So that's a summary of how the whole thing works.
Mm-hmm.
We know this to be a fact because George Bush, that's H.W. Bush, he announced one day in his major speech to the Senate, he said, what we need is a new world order. And since then, it's been used by almost every president who has succeeded George Bush. So
yes.
There's no secret about it at all. And there's no secret that we largely carry out the dictates of this body. And until we learn to free ourselves of the toils of this organization, we will not really be free in the fullest sense of the word.
Yes. Would you agree that the biggest danger to their existence is the disclosure of who they are and how they operate? I mean, that's basically what you've done in your book.
That's right. That's the thing that they fear the most, and anybody who tries to do that is stamped out. And people say to me, well, what happened to you? How come you're still around? Well, in my case, I published the book before I started saying anything, and by that time the genie was out of the bottle. And that I was considered, if I was to be dealt with by them, they knew very well that I'd have a greater following than possible if I hadn't been dealt with. So they left me strictly alone, and they said, well, this story will be greeted by most people as being utterly preposterous, and very few are going to believe it. But I'm thankful to say that the word has gone around the world. My book, The Committee of 300, has been translated into 7 different foreign languages, and I think it's been read by many, many millions, untold millions of people. So in that regard, it's no good trying to put the horse back in the stable. And I've been fortunate to be left alone.
Well, I've had a taste of what you're talking about myself, and so have many of my colleagues, either in broadcasting or in journalism. We come under attack when we reveal a truth that's just what it is, a truth that's been hidden maybe for thousands of years. And so I think we have a certain dispensation. Maybe it's sacred, in a sense, to bring this information out, to share it with people. After all, it's only information, and we have a right to know it, do we not?
I think that's right, and I think that certainly we do have an absolute bounden duty to try and bring as much of this information out in public. And that's what's been happening in my career so far. I've really striven to do this, and my quest has not been for money. Goodness knows that's true, because I don't have any. But my quest has been for people to learn the truth and to be set free by it.
Yes. Now, you mentioned some presidents, and I think, yes, we have these events, assassinations, false flag events, wars that are contrived to fuel this thing, to make money. These are just a series of Ponzi schemes committed under the pretense of bringing about peace, and bringing about, the word they like to use is democracy.
And patriotism, another overworked word.
Oh, yes, yes. And so there is this aspect of the, I don't want to call them ancient, but the original agreements that the United States or America, early America, I'm talking about in the days of the founding fathers, there were these secret agreements between the British Crown and, I suppose you could say, the City of London. At least it's evolved into that.
Well, that's right. There are two Londons. The City of London is the financial heart of much of the world, and everything that's transacted, whether it be gold or precious metals or currency, the basis and the foundation of the trading is done in London, in the City of London, which is not it has its own charter and it's a separate city. It's in London, but it's not part of London.
It's like the Vatican in Italy.
Exactly.
Yes. Or the UN in the United States. Now, whether these things are lawful or constitutional is one issue, but what do you suppose goes through the mind of the average individual when they're met with this information and they contemplate that actually what we've been taught from our history books throughout our education in the public school system, for example, and many of the universities, we've been lied to about some of these realities, these secret societies and the power they wield over getting certain types of international agreements composed and signed without our knowledge. Sometimes taking 100 or 200 years to discover what's actually been done.
To talk about contrived situations, all wars begin with contrived situations. You take Pearl Harbor, for instance, was a contrived situation from A to Z. The Japanese had no chance of attacking mainland America. They just would be blotted out. So Roosevelt and his cronies, Stimson, and his war cabinet said, well, we've got to do something. We have to make a contrived situation that will make the Japanese fire the first shot. And that's precisely what they did. Roosevelt ordered the United States Pacific Fleet to be moved from its absolutely safe anchorage in San Diego all across the Pacific into Pearl Harbor, right under the nose of the Japanese Empire, and a tempting target, which they said, thank you very much, we'll take that. And we know that this is what happened. Roosevelt was willing to sacrifice the lives of almost 3,000 American servicemen at Pearl Harbor to achieve his goal of having the Japanese attack the United States. And what was this for? It was in continuation of his promise to another warmonger, Winston Churchill of Great Britain, who he met aboard the Prince of Wales just off the coast of Newfoundland. They met there so that if it was ever discovered what they'd been talking about, they could be not be charged under U.S. law for a conspiracy. So that was all, the whole thing was settled there, and the Pacific Fleet was moved right out across the Pacific into San Diego, where they were virtually at the mercy of the Japanese, which had a very, very substantial navy. And, of course, they said, this is just fine with us, and they launched this major attack on Pearl Harbor. And the tragedy of this is compounded by the fact that Roosevelt knew for 6 months before it happened that an attack was coming, and he knew within 2 weeks of when the Japanese main battle fleet was to sail from Japan to attack Pearl Harbor. Yet he never gave his commanders on the ground any warning. He never gave his Air Force commanders or Navy commanders any warning whatsoever. And he let the Japanese fall on them and destroy Pearl Harbor and half of the United States fleet and almost 3,000 of our servicemen. And then he said, well, now we are now going to respond to this by entering the war in Europe. Of course, he couldn't get the American people to do this directly. In other words, the American people were not interested in fighting a war in Europe. They had no quarrel with the Germans, and they said, we certainly don't intend to go to war. In Europe, what for? It's not our war. We're keeping out of it. So by this devious means, by this contrived situation, Roosevelt was able to get the United States into a world war, and kept his promise to Churchill, as I said, which was made on board the British battleship Prince of Wales, and it was, of course, a very big step forward, and the United States was completely devastated by this entry into war, and the people didn't oppose it because they knew. They said, well, we have to defend our homeland. Look at what's happened. These people launched a treacherous attack upon them, upon the United States, and then we may be next. Germany's next going to attack us. That's what the story was put out about, that Germany also planned to attack the United States. And Roosevelt said, well, this is something we've got to take care of by getting into the war and stopping them from doing this. When he made his famous war speech, he waved a piece of paper in the air, and he said, I have in my hands here a telegram from the German High Command to its officers and its Navy at sea, and ordering them to launch an attack on the Panama Canal and close the Panama Canal. So the United States was bamboozled, if I may use that word. The people were completely at a loss to understand what was going on, and they suddenly found that here they were facing two enemies, and the only thing their president, and the United States look up, the people look up to their president, and usually they will be very keen and happy to obey the president's commands, especially in time of war. And therefore, that you have the situation where we were now menaced by the Germans on one hand and by the Japanese on the other. And the only way to get the people to agree, of course, was to have them fire the first shot. The Japanese did that. And that's how we found ourselves in World War II. And it cost the lives of 20 million young men, the flower of the nations of Europe and the United States.
Now, how do you suppose the Hilo Herald on December 6th, 1941, published a headline on their newspaper?
A day of infamy. The day of infamy was supposed to be the infamous attack by the Japanese on Pearl Harbor, but in my view, in my mind, I think the most infamous part of that day was Roosevelt's treachery towards his own American people.
Yes.
That was certainly a day of infamy in my mind.
Yes, yes. The day before the attack on Pearl Harbor, their headline ran, "Pearl Harbor may be attacked."
Yes, that's right.
Of course, we weren't taught that in history, you see, nor were, and you mentioned Churchill, and I'm trying to recall who that was in those negotiations. There were a couple of other countries involved because their intent, this was sort of NATO before NATO actually existed.
That's what he said, and that's what the orders were. That's what the press learned from Roosevelt and the presidential decrees that came out and the directives and the announcements he asked the press to publish for him. This is more or less the thrust of what they were. But we know now today that the whole thing was a contrived situation.
Yes. Now, we have all these, if I may say so, Dr. Coleman, we have all these secret societies that are part of, let's say, they're branches of the Illuminati's Committee of 300. And those would be various financial entities that play worldwide roles, whether it's a pharmaceutical company, a bank, an oil company. You get the idea of what I'm saying.
I do have them. And, in my book, I very clearly spell out who these companies are. List every one of them, as well as the personnel who are at the top of controlling these companies. So the book is very substantial in that it certainly goes into detail and doesn't just talk about they. It tells you who the they are.
Yes.
I think that's important for the American people or readers to know, that this book is very much detailed, and you'll certainly find names and people in there that you won't find probably in any other book. Encyclopedias even, and I haven't seen these names.
That's been something I've noticed, having read your book after maybe 15 years or so after I had begun my own research, and really not knowing what I was going to find, other than I was just a truth seeker. I was looking for the truth about why things were so different, why we were told the things about Europe when I was in the United States that we were told and taught and led to believe, and only to see that those things weren't true. And then coming back from that experience, it was a culture shock for me, seeing the deterioration of the country. And how certain things that were going on in Europe were kept from the American people. And I'm sure, conversely, the Europeans didn't know a lot about what was happening in the United States.
That's absolutely correct. And the thing is that, America, the United States of America, is really not a country. It's 50 different states, 50 different nations, countries, that came together for the convenience of having a government and for carrying out civic duties and passing laws. But we really, even in the days of George III, you'll see there that they talked about all these states, all these nation states, meaning the actual different states in the United States of America. So it's very difficult to make it something that applies to every state in the United States, because yeah. each one under the Constitution had its own constitution, its own set of laws, and its own local government, and of course they were not supposed to be subservient to the federal government in Washington. But that's largely been negated through all kinds of contrived situations, and mm-hmm. let's never forget that the most hated document ever published and hated by the Committee of 300 is the United States Constitution. In my opinion, it's second only to the Bible as the greatest document in the history of the world.
Yes, my my own experience with both both issues is that God inspired this country to be an example for the world, but it was hijacked. There's no doubt about that, and it's being hijacked today. Now you mention traitors, and certainly we understand what that word is. I sort of coined a word in my research because I found out that many of these who were calling traitors are actually people who have infiltrated the country, and so I call them infill traitors.
Well, exactly. You know, when the British wanted to secure control of the finances of the United States, they sent Paul Warburg from Germany, who was head of the Reichsbank in Germany, they mm-hmm. sent him to the United States, and he inveigled his way into the good graces of many of the senators and congressmen, and then they turned to him and said, well, look, you've been head of this powerful big bank. Why don't you draft something for us that we can follow with regard to establish our own financial system? And that's one of the ways that the Federal Reserve Bank was able to come into being.
Mm-hmm. And my own research uncovered some passenger manifests at Ellis Island. And these individuals, Paul Warburg and those from Kuhn and Loeb and the Harrimans and all of these banksters, as we call them, in New York, who had ties to London, Germany, France, working overseas with the Rothschilds, and then over here with the Rockefellers and J.P. Morgan. These were all agents for the same people over there in Europe. The point I want to make is that I found that roughly 10 to 15 years prior to the establishment of the Federal Reserve Act, these individuals were already sneaking into the country. And I say sneaking into the country because they would make statements like, I'm a U.S. citizen, then turn around some months later or a year later and say, I've never been to the United States. I'm from Germany. I was born in Germany. And I found this consistently on every banking family that I suspected infiltrated the country as agents, let's say, for this overthrow, this takeover of the country and ultimately the world. So, We had traitors working in the various bureaucracies that oversee immigration, the INS. Certainly, these individuals were bribed, and the documents, the ancient documents that these secret societies reference in their works, in their meetings, and their public speeches, detail the very things we're going to bribe. Officials, we're going to bribe our way into the country and set up shop, basically. Does this sound strange to you? Because
no, it sounds exactly like what's happened. You take the Bavarian traitor who wrote to the Illuminati, Adam Weishaupt.
Mm-hmm.
He said they've got to destroy religions. That's what he said. That's the foundation of all of these monarchies that are standing in the way of a new world order. And particularly at that time, the Catholic Church was preeminent all throughout Europe and also to a lesser extent in the United States. But he said, as far as Europe is concerned, we are going to get inside the Catholic Church and bore away at it until there's nothing but rotten timbers left and the whole thing collapses. So these people don't act in a vacuum. They act according to precise plans that are laid out well in advance, and they've been doing this for many, many years, and I believe in my heart they're still doing it.
Yes. I've been doing some genealogies on various presidents or politicians who aspire to the presidency, and in every case I've found that these people are not who they say they are. They're not even born in this country, and there seems to be a very strong connection, whether it's through Franz Joseph I of Austria-Hungary, I think one of the longest-running autocrats in history of the world, 68 years he was in power, and at the root cause of World War I. And I found that Dwight David Eisenhower himself was an infiltrator. And just comparing the Ellis Island documents to published documents at the Presidential Museum and the National Archives, they can't seem to get his birthplace straight. and I actually discovered the date when he infiltrated the country, which was in 1924, nowhere near 1890, like they say. In your research, did you stumble across individuals like this who had been sent from one country, maybe at an early age, or maybe just programmed for a period of time to shake their accent or to learn the language, to concoct a story and infiltrate the country? Usually it was done via the shipping companies into the military and or into a university or under the auspices of a university or a military academy. And then this individual would be involved in war, come back, run for office, and the first shot, claim the presidency, never having held another office. You want to talk about made men? I guess my question is, had you run into any of that in your own research? Well, it seems like we lost Dr. Coleman. Seth, if you're paying attention, could you see about getting Dr. Coleman back on the line? And Seth is doing that. I don't know if he heard my question. And we're approaching that 3 seconds of silence, which is deadly for the radio. Well, just for your information, while we're waiting for Dr. Coleman, this is going to be a 2-night series. He will be with us again tomorrow evening. And that's hoping that we get him back on right now. It's amazing what happens when the truth comes out. Later on this week, Friday night, I have scientist inventor Jim Murray back, and we're going to be continuing a discussion on some suppressed methods of power production. And do we have Dr. Coleman back with us now?
I am back on the line. I don't know what happened on my side. Suddenly there was a strong beeping, and then the line went dead completely. That's never happened to me before, so I have no idea what was going on.
That happens sometimes when the truth gets out there.
I would think so.
Well, that means, you know, you don't get the flak unless you're over the target. So,
right.
Well, basically, I was paraphrasing some of my own discoveries about certain individuals. I don't know if you heard me mention that, but I was wondering if you had encountered anything such as infiltration, specifically being able to possibly identify a politician or a military leader as someone who was inserted, infiltrated into either our government or our military. Had you experienced that at all?
Actually, I've never made a list of these people, but I'm sure that I can try to find something and bring it on perhaps tomorrow night, I don't know. But this is something I can look into in the meantime. But I have no idea. I know, if I have every idea who they are, but I've not listed them.
Yes, the reason I bring up this point, Dr. Coleman, and I think it's just common sense or basic logic, that if you have a leader of your country, or whether it's the president or a senator or a congressman, who is willing to do things to undermine the best interests of the country and its populace, one would have to ask the question, who does this individual represent? And that's what I'd like to get to. I think our listening audience would appreciate what you have to say.
Well, I would say absolutely straight off the reel, representing the people in the New World Order Committee of 300, because that's where they get their orders from. As I said in the beginning of the program, it comes from the Harold Pratt House in London. That's transmitted to Morgan Guarantee, and then they send their messages to the State Department. And from there, it's transmitted to the various individuals. So I have no doubt in my mind that these things come directly from the Committee of 300.
Yes. Now, we have, for the sake of our listeners, would you like to go into that a little bit? And, of course, we don't have to cover the whole topic in one show. Hopefully, we'll have you back to continue this discussion.
But as I said earlier, the policies that are formulated in Harold Pratt House are the policies of the Committee of 300. And then they were transmitted to Morgan Guarantee on Wall Street, which was the agent, the representation for the people in London, the Royal Institute for International Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
So whomever they had selected as their man or their men received these messages, and they faithfully carried them out. But as for the list of them, I'd have to look back and see where I have a list of them, and perhaps I can give it to you at a later date.
Yeah, that would be fine. But we could basically say that some of these members of the Committee of 300 could be compartmentalized into a particular...
Hello?
Yes, I'm still here. Seth, I think we're having an audio problem here.
Hmm.
Stay with us, Dr. Coleman, if you can hear me.
I didn't hear you. It faded out completely. The last.
Okay, Seth, can you check on the connection, please? Okay, he's on it. Hopefully, I'll just keep talking here until Dr. Coleman can hear. This is interesting. Quite interesting. We haven't even begun to detail these things, and already we're having technical problems. Well, we'll be patient here. Seth, the moment you have Dr. Coleman on, if you would let me know, I would appreciate it. And I guess we're still waiting. Okay, I hear someone now. Are you back with us, Dr. Coleman? Nope, that wasn't Dr. Coleman. Oh. Okay, he wasn't hearing me, so I don't know what happened there. We were doing fine up until that point. This is, I asked the magic question there. They don't want this information to come out. And so we experience interference. That proves a point, again, that we're on target. Well, I suppose I could, again, remind you on tomorrow evening, Dr. Coleman will be back with us, and we'll be continuing this discussion and another topic regarding another book that he wrote, And
I can hear you, but I don't hear.
Okay, I'm hearing you.
Answer too well.
Okay, are you hearing me now?
I can hear you now.
Oh, okay. We're hearing each other. That means the audience can hear us. Okay. Don't know what's going on, but well, basically, you were about to describe some of the things that you had discovered. And I don't expect you to go into a itemized list, but could you paraphrase how these participants are maybe grouped into fields or certain aspects of the economy?
Well, it's usually money and plenty of it. That's the basic denominator. That's it. It's the old story.
Mm-hmm. It's just money now. So are you saying the banks are at the top, or would it be those who, certain elements?
No, those who serve the Committee of 300 at the top of banks, insurance companies, finance houses, trade missions, everything of that nature. They're all Committee of 300 people, chosen and selected. And these are the people that also, of course, score big as far as their financial rewards are concerned.
Yes.
So it's very, very much like a clearinghouse for people who are willing to sell their souls to the devil, and those who are not willing to do that and don't get anywhere, and those who do reach the top, the zenith of their profession. There are many good people who never see anything in the way of those type of top jobs. I'm not saying everybody has a top job is like that, but I would say there's certainly a very good percentage in all countries out of that mind.
Yes, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that information is highly compartmentalized under need-to-know basis, and so people do their job, whether it's pushing a pencil or copying papers or taking notes, attending meetings, scheduling interviews or planning speeches, you know, the things that they bombard society with that really don't disclose what's going on.
That's what's happening most of the time.
Yes. And
what you read in the papers, of course, you might as well dismiss that.
Mm-hmm.
Not even worth passing along.
Yeah, it's become nothing but propaganda and indoctrination. Very subtle. And I know that we're going to be talking on that issue on another show, so we won't go into that in any detail other than to say things are not what they appear to be.
No, that's absolutely correct. And I wonder if I could ask you if you wouldn't mind mentioning my website where people can go and see all the works I've written. I have 17 books and many, many white paper monographs I think would be of interest to people. And if they wish to purchase any of them, could you mention my website? It's Coleman300, that's 300.com.
Pretty simple, Coleman300.com.
That's it. And then if anybody wants to call directly, they can call 1-800-942-0821.
Okay, that's 800-942-0821.
Yes, and if you could mention that, I'd be very appreciative. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'll be sure to do that before the show concludes, as well as throughout the week. How's that?
That sounds great. Thank you so much.
Well, Dr. Coleman, many people have heard much of the information that is in your book. And I've seen your work in some other books, as I mentioned at the top of the show. I think attribution is important because of the wealth of information that you bring to the table. Much of it from experience, much of it from a lot of research and hard study. And I know that it's research like this can be thankless in many ways, and there are those that would try to debunk it or try to claim it as their own. And
yes, unfortunately, that's true. I've had probably, I wouldn't say that my work is probably the most plagiarized in the United States, but it's pretty close to it.
Yeah. Some say Bob Chapman, the economist, gets plagiarized quite a bit. But here you're dealing with something which is really outside the box in terms of revealing information that otherwise wouldn't have come out. And, you know, it's obvious that you're a man of God, that the Creator inspired you to put this together, to basically blow the whistle or sound the horn, sound the trumpet.
Yes, that's true. I have been, of course, I'm a Christian, and I've tried to do the right thing. And if I have information, the right thing to do is give it out.
Mm-hmm. Again, I don't want to touch on tomorrow's topic, but what do you suppose has been the most successful means through which this whole scheme has been carried out? I know time is, you know, the length of time that this has been going on plays a major role, sort of like a turtle just taking its time, getting to the end of the journey, maybe not as fast as it would like, but these things move at a snail's pace sometimes. Suddenly we're in this time period within the last few years where people are waking up and they're ramping up the speed at which they're carrying all of this agenda out. Do you see it that way? And what
yes,
are your
I
thoughts?
I do. From the beginning, when we talk about this in another broadcast, from the beginning, propaganda has played a huge role.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the way that it's presented is not recognized as propaganda. And I think without propaganda, there are many wars that would never have been fought, and some of the situations that pertain in the world today would never have come into being. But propaganda has been a deadly weapon in the hands of the conspirators. And it's a very, very skillful science. It is a science.
Mm-hmm. I see the organizations that are carrying this out and the crimes that are committed in the name of this New World Order. How do you suppose they've gotten away with this to the extent they have? Is it total subjugation and blackmail or extortion of those that play the role, the various roles that hoodwink the public into believing that the system is a certain way when in reality it's not?
That's true, but as I said earlier, the greatest weapon they have is the science of propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And people will believe anything if they think it's the truth. And so much of what we've heard in the last, since 1914, has been propaganda, which has been sharpened and honed to a fine art today, to a scientific practice. And what we're getting instead of truth is propaganda, but people don't recognize it as propaganda. And so they will carry out or obey or listen or believe the things that they're being told.
Mm-hmm. It's quite clear why they are pitting certain religions against the Christian religion or Christianity. I hate the word religion because it's just a way to describe an organization that has its own agenda, regardless of how it presents itself to the public or to its membership. It's often something quite different behind the scenes as, you know, compared to what you think you're going to see. Let's say it's a church that's following the Holy Bible and using the Bible as the basis or the foundation for their religious convictions.
That's right. The Constitution is, of course, based upon the Bible. And the United States has been three times declared a Christian nation by the Supreme Court. Not many people know that, but that's never been reversed or overturned. And, of course, all the principles of the Constitution are based upon the scriptures of the Bible, the Christian Bible. And so I think we must not lose sight of the fact that America, despite the many isms that have crept in, is a Christian nation. But we must never lose that heritage.
Mm-hmm. Why do you suppose it's so difficult for most people to see the intention to pit religions against each other for the propagation of war, which has its own reasons behind the scenes, making money, as you said? Is it that these individuals, these Satanists, hate?
Well, many religions started out very, very well. The Christian religion, too, in the early days, you had the Crusades. Now, that was a religious war. And the Crusades were mounted by people on the basis of the holy religion of Christianity. Mm. And by the time the Crusades was a few years old, it was nothing but a dreadful money-making business. So it was completely ruined. It had lost its, like the Bible said, the salt had lost its taste. And it was no longer worth anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then this predispensation for destroying Islam.
That's right. They went to fight the war against Islam.
Now, who do you see is behind that? I ask that sort of naively, just not so I don't put words in your mouth. Many speculate that it could be the British Crown, the City of London, the Vatican. You get the idea.
There's no doubt in my mind that the originator of all this was the British Crown. Definitely.
Okay, and the British Crown, as my research and some that I've studied of others, shows me that those individuals, and I suppose it's the whole infrastructure of how this economic system has been hatched, they're not British themselves.
No, they're not.
Yes. What has your research led you to discover? My listeners know my thoughts on this, but I'm interested in hearing what you have to say.
Well, take Queen Victoria now. She was greatly recognized in British history as a great monarch, a great queen, and she was very much loved by all of her subjects. But she was from the House of Guelph, some of the most evil people in the Venetian hierarchy in Venice and the other big city in there, and they were Guelph, Black Guelphs. They were known as Black Guelphs by the local people because of their deeds. Their deeds were so foul that they referred to these people as a black nobility. And these were the people who formulated all of these things.
Okay. Do you...
And Queen Victoria was a Black Guelph.
Mm-hmm.
She was actually German. Did you know that she couldn't speak English hardly at all?
Well, that wouldn't surprise me. we have this group that are referred to today, the bankers and many of the Committee of 300. These are Zionists. Now, they equate this, and they throw this in our face all the time about slandering the Jewish people, and they are not Jews themselves. They are masquerading as something else. My research
goes...
Yes,
that's a very bad subject, and I don't think there's time to get into that tonight. I don't know the time. We have 11 o'clock as your finishing time, isn't that right?
Well, we had a couple of interruptions, so we still have some minutes here. I'm not saying we should go into that, but, you know...
No, that is too vast a subject to tackle now. It's really subject for another time, I'm sure. We can get into a lot of detail about that.
Yes, I would love to do that, because I see the footprints. That's why I call my show Evident Footprints. I see the footprints leading up to what we're experiencing today. And it's this regurgitation of the attack on these poor people who have been maligned throughout history, driven from their lands, given a homeland. And it appears to me that all the evil is emanating from that very place.
There's no doubt about it in my mind at all.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right.
Well, I'm it's nice to have you agree with me.
I have to agree with you because you're right, absolutely. My research shows me that's the case.
Yes, and reading your book, I have to say that you're very pragmatic, very factual. You don't dance around the subject. You get right to the heart of all the details that you're bringing out. I don't find you speculating.
No, most of my work, well, nearly 99% of it is actually very factual. And another thing, too, I don't use pedantic English or long-sounding words. I write in a very plain English that everybody can understand.
Well, I hope I haven't used any pedantic words myself. I think pedantic is one, but...
You got me there.
What I see, and I know we're going to be discussing this, what I see is what we're taught, what we're told about history, and what really has happened is actually the opposite. You know, we're dealing with Hegel's dialectical argument here constantly, and whether you want to talk about how it was applied by Karl Marx or carried out by Stalin, Lenin, these figures that invaded countries on behalf of these bankers, or banksters, as we like to call them, to propagate wars to overthrow countries and really put the world in chaos to get this machine.
That's the whole idea of everything. Throw the world into chaos, get people unbalanced, and then, of course, they're not going to think about too much about who's causing it and what the problem is, what the real problem is. All they want to do is get out of it and get back to their normal lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a massive undertaking, and it's been going on for many, many centuries. One could even argue thousands of years. And it's probably occurred many times in the world's past. It's just that we don't have the history in the average history book. But I think a lot of that's being uncovered today. What do you see? Let me ask you this, this is probably the most frank answer you could give. What was your purpose for writing your book? What were you hoping to accomplish?
I hope to enlighten people, to give them light on subjects that have been so obscurely dealt with, they've dealt with at all. And, of course, I never set out to make a huge fortune, neither have I done so. And I've certainly just managed to keep myself going on my own work without donations or anything from anybody. And my sole purpose was to bring enlightenment from what I saw were subjects that really badly need to be enlightened on. People needed that. It was a huge need in the world.
Yes. And it still is today. Now, what is coming to light is through your work and the work of some others, is this long-standing relationship between these secret societies and the committees and the foundations and the think tanks and the representative groups that sort of act as intermediaries for all of these groups. They've set up a web. Is it any surprise that they call the internet the web?
No, no surprise at all.
Or
not
that
at
they
all.
Call, yeah, that they call a radio, a set of radio stations, broadcasting companies, TV studios, networks, working the net. I mean, it's all there. They deal a lot with semantics, don't they? They
tell us absolutely. That's the most important thing for them. The right word, the right phrase for the right occasion.
Yes. So how do you feel so far that you've succeeded in your quest to make this information known to people?
I feel that I won't say successful, but I've opened doors for many people, and people have said to me that the things that they never understood at all, they understand very well now. I've had many, many hundreds of letters addressed to me along those lines.
Mm-hmm. When one is usually accused of having an axe to grind when a certain group is mentioned.
I don't think you'll find that in any of my work. I have no axe to grind at all.
Yes.
Neither do I blame one group of people other than the Committee of 300.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people who are responsible for all of the misinformation, all the problems, the troubles of the world. At least in my opinion, for what it's worth.
Yes. Now, is there a part that one of these smaller groups, let's say like the Club of Rome, has a superior authoritative license over, let's say, the Committee of 300? Is there any one group or any set of groups that one could look at to understand how they get this large group of the committee to actually move in the same flow? Have we lost Dr. Coleman again? Oh my goodness, Seth, if you're listening in, let's try one more time to get Dr. John Coleman on the air. Okay, he's on it. This is quite interesting. Quite interesting. All right, I think, well, no, not yet. I'll know. I'll hear the impedance change when he's on. Well, again, I'll mention scientist inventor Jim Murray will be with us on Friday night. We're going to be continuing our discussion on suppressed inventions in the area of power production. Some like to call it free energy. We may talk about that as well. And Dr. John Coleman will be with us also tomorrow night. Okay. He must be having a problem with his phone. If you can't get him in the next minute, Seth, we'll just close out the show and try to make contact with him. As a recap, if you would like to get a copy of Conspirators' Hierarchy, the story of the Committee of 300, or any of the other books that Dr. John Coleman has written, certainly I encourage you to go to his website. That's Coleman300.com, spelled out Coleman, the number 300.com. And he also said that you can call toll-free. That number is 800, put a 1 in front of that, 942-0821. And I'm sure they'll be able to get you even multiple copies of the book. You may want to give a couple of those to your local library as a gift, and or to a family member or a friend. Fascinating information. Okay. I guess Dr. Coleman is going to retire for the night, so we want to thank him for having been on Evident Footprints, and he will be back with us again tomorrow night. We've got a very interesting topic, and it's going to deal with much of what we've been discussing on Evident Footprints for the past year. fascinating research he's done in that regard. Be sure to tune in. I want to thank those Wind Talkers Radio Network broadcasters out there for carrying the show tonight. Over at BBS Radio, Seth Hendrick on the sound, Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. I'll see you all here tomorrow night, again with Dr. John Coleman. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.